Philippians 1:21.
For to me, to live is Christ.
To live is Christ.
To live is Christ.
And to die.
And to die.
And to die is gain.
Is gain.
Is gain.
Again?
For to me,
to live is
Christ.
And
to die
is
gain.
For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain.
Well, we want to welcome all of you on all our campuses today, especially if you're new to CCV. You've actually landed here on a really great weekend. We're starting a new summer series, Joyride. Isn't this the right time to talk about joy? When your pool's open, you got summer vacation coming, your kids are out of school. Unless, of course, you can't afford to go on vacation, or you don't have a pool and your kids are driving you nuts, then you really need Joyride. So we're going to spend the whole month of June in the book of Philippians talking about how to bring joy to your life. This is the right series, and this is actually the right time of the series. You know, we know more about joy and happiness today than we've ever known. About 1998, there was this explosion of studies of happiness. Scientists and physicians and social scientists were gathering together to figure out what makes us happy, why we get happy, and what happens when we're happy. You won't be surprised to know that happy people make better spouses. Hello. Happy people make better parents. Happy people make better workers. The happiest people are actually the healthiest people. You realize that happy people, on average, live 10 years longer than unhappy people. But will happiness help you make more money? Turns out it does, actually. This is stunning, that your level of happiness is more impactful for your level of income than is your level of education. Isn't that extraordinary? So I don't care where you are on the spiritual spectrum. If you're just like investigating church, you're not really bought in, or you've been a Christian all your life, wherever you are, happiness is a universal human longing. And we want to talk about how to help you become happier. It's the right series, it's the right time, and Philippians is actually the right book. Now, about 5 weeks ago, you might remember, we challenged the whole church to read through the book of Philippians. Now, some of you have been reading, it's just four chapters. It's not even really a book, it's a letter, right? Just four little chapters. So we said, read one chapter a day, 4 days a week, for 5 weeks running. If you did that, you know why we chose this book. In fact, even if you just got started and read one chapter or read through it one time, you know why we chose this book. Pound per pound, there is more happiness in this book of Philippians than any other book of the Bible. Now, that's actually really stunning when you realize that when Paul wrote this book, he was wearing something that looked like this. He was in chains at the time, put into prison in stocks. Now, these particular stocks are made for two on your ankles and two on your wrists. That's not what Paul wore. And I put these on to illustrate something important. When Paul wore his chains, they were just on his hands. He was in house arrest. But next to him was chained a soldier to his right and a soldier to his left for 4 years. Now, for a guy like Paul that loves to travel, that plants churches, that preaches all over the place, a 4-year prison sentence is like an eternity. How in the world, wearing chains, do you write a letter that has so much happiness in it? That's what I want to find out, don't you? Look, all of us have chains, something that inhibits our happiness. And I want you to name your chain. Like, what is it right now inhibiting your happiness? For some of you, it might be a sickness, or a bankruptcy, or a father wound. For others, your chain, like if you named your chain, it has a name, like it's a person, your spouse, or a child, or a boss. Somebody is negatively impacting your level of happiness, and you've got a name. I want you to name your chain, because if you can name it, you can deal with it better. In fact, I want to share with you my chain. A number of years ago, I found myself pretty unhappy in ministry. Like, I had hit a wall. And like other unhappy people, I had plenty of other people to blame. She said this, and he did that, and this situation arose. But because I am a naturally happy person, this really took my breath away. Like, I was stunned. And I would be embarrassed to tell you how long I was unhappy. And I realized, like, I was self-aware enough to know my happiness is my choice. So even though I could point fingers to other people and things, it was my choice to be happy or unhappy. So I decided to do something about it. I pulled out my journal, and I just made a list of all the things that made me happy. I came up with about 30 things. A gourmet meal makes me happy. A long embrace with my wife makes me happy. Sunsets, exercise. Kittens did not make the list. But I started noticing with these 30 items that there were, they naturally gravitated to categories. So for example, adventure is one of my categories. So traveling, exercise, anything with adrenaline, love it. And there's other categories like peace, shalom at home, peace with my wife, peace with my friends, peace in my relationships. But I noticed that these categories sometimes vied for my energy. So when I would go out and have a blast traveling or maybe do something that's stupidly dangerous that I just love, my wife is at home. And so these two categories of happiness, when one rose, the other naturally lowered, like a seesaw. And then I realized with these external forces that were making me unhappy, that where happiness was lowered in one area, it created a wide lane in another area for me to train for happiness. So all I did was, with the 30 items, I rated them 1 to 5, like Likert scale, just put little dots, 1 to 5, on all 30, and I came up with a measure of how happy I was. And then I put a check mark by every item that was under my control. Like, I control a good cup of coffee. I control a gourmet meal. I control going out and watching the sunset. So I decided to schedule what makes me happy. And after 6 months, I redid the evaluation again, and in fact, I had gotten out of my funk because I took control of my own happiness. And you can too. But there's something more. When you wear a chain, you can't control the chain that you wear. Somebody else put that on you. But you can control what you do with the chain that others put on you. And the Apostle Paul is a brilliant example of this. How does a guy wearing a chain find so much joy in life? That I want to know about. See, there are just some people that get tougher under pressure. For example, there are some athletes, do not taunt them. Because if you're playing a game and you taunt that athlete, if you make him mad, he will make every single shot. Don't go there. Who are these people? Like, what do you call these people that get tougher under pressure? I never had a name for them until 2014. A book came out by Nassim Taleb, and the title of the book is the name of these people who get better under pressure. You want to know what it is? Anti-Fragile. That's the name of the book. So he opens the book by asking a simple question. What is the opposite of fragile? Well, fragile is something that breaks under pressure. A teacup is fragile. So what is not fragile? Most people say, well, something that's strong, like steel, stone, bone, all strong, but they all break under pressure. So they're not as fragile. They're still fragile. They're just less fragile than a teacup. I want to know, can you think of anything that actually gets better under pressure? If you're thinking of anything, it's probably a diamond. A diamond gets better under pressure. But it's not the only thing. You know what else gets better under pressure? Your character. If you manage it well. And Nassim Taleb, he wrote a lot of things that get better under pressure. A mob, more pressure you put out of it, the bigger it gets. The internet, the more pressure you put on it, the bigger it gets. Uber, the more pressure you put on it, the bigger it gets. I mean, there are a lot of things. Entrepreneurs, some of them make way more money the worse the economy gets. Some artists produce their best work when tragedy strikes. There's a group of people that are anti-fragile, and I want to be in that circle of people. Don't you want to be tough as nails and stronger under pressure? Here is Paul's secret. I'm going to lay it out, and then we're going to look at how it unfolds in Philippians chapter 1. Here's what Paul says will make you better under pressure. When you prioritize your purpose over your position. See, chains will always lower your position. When you go to prison, you lower in your freedom. You lower in your honor. You lower in your economics. Chains will always inhibit your position, but they don't have to inhibit your happiness. They don't have to inhibit your purpose in life. And if you live life on purpose, chains can actually be a force multiplier for your life effectiveness. It's not just true of Paul. It is just as true today. Nelson Mandela, classic example. One of the greatest leaders of the 20th century became famous worldwide because of his chains. So I want to look at lesson number one from the first chapter of Philippians. What happens when you wear chains? First thing that happens, your relationships are clarified. Dude, you go to prison, you find out real quick who your friends are. You get a terminal disease, you find out real quick who the important people are in your life. If you go to bankrupt, you find out real fast who are the people that you can count on. When your relationships are clarified, that raises your happiness. Why? Because all the research that we've done on happiness say that your relationships are the foundation of your happiness. And when those are clarified, your happiness raises. Well, that's what happened to Paul. Listen how he opens the book. He gives a greeting, then verse 3. I thank my God every time I remember you. In all my prayers for all of you, I always pray with, there it is, joy. Because of your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now, being confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion until the day of Christ Jesus. Paul's relationship with the Philippians was clarified through chains. And maybe you notice in the text these words, remember, first day, God began a good work in you. Paul is remembering back to a decade-old friendship. 10 years earlier, Paul is now in chains in Rome. 10 years earlier, he had been in chains in Philippi. It's an extraordinary story. You can fact check me by reading Acts, the 16th chapter in the New Testament. But Paul goes to Philippi, northern Greece, and there's no synagogue there like most of the places where he preached. But there were some women down at the river praying, so he goes to these Jewish gals and he starts to preach. Whenever Paul preaches, a crowd begins to gather. And as the crowd gathered, the entourage got thicker, people going from the town to the river, from the river back to town. One of the people in the entourage was a girl. She was a teenager, 13, 14 years old. She was demon-possessed. And that demon empowered her to predict the future. So her owners would rent her out to clients who paid big bucks to find out, will this person fall in love with me? Will this business venture succeed? Will my wife die? And this little girl helped them see the future. Now, she was a fan of Paul. And as Paul is going out to the river, she's following along going, hey, you need to listen to this guy. This guy's telling you how to be saved. Now, there's nothing particularly wrong with what she said. But as a fellow preacher, I will tell you, I don't want my primary PR person to be a demon-possessed teenage girl. That's what Twitter is for. Listen, Paul wheels around and points at the demon and says, you, out now. And the demon's going, I don't want any part of Paul. Like, that dude has some spiritual power. He'll mess you up. So the demon leaves. So does her ability to predict the future. And now we got a problem. The owners are furious. And they grab Paul and drag him to the center of town. It's called the Agora. It's the open marketplace. Everybody's there. They're buying and selling and shopping and education, and the court was there. So they put Paul on this stone in front of the judge right up there. I've actually stood on that stone, still there today. And they accused Paul of a career-ending crime, disturbing the peace. Now, I know when you say disturbing the peace, a big deal. You played your music too loud. No, actually, for the Romans, it was a big deal. You see, the Roman government had expanded so quickly, so far, that they were always in danger on the margins of riots. So maybe you've read in history how when there was an uprising in Rome, they just squashed it as hard as they could, as quickly as they could. So anybody accused of disturbing the peace would be beaten, and Paul was. They pulled out these billy clubs the size of broomsticks, and they were just wailing on Paul and Silas, who was preaching with them. They beat those two until they could not stand, put their legs in stocks, and threw them in a dungeon overnight. You know what Paul and Silas did in the dungeon? Wearing shackles, wearing foot fetters, they sang praise and prayers to God. Unbelievable. The other prisoners, they had never heard anything like that, not in prison. And then God answered their prayers with an earthquake. Boom. The whole building rattles. The doors fly open. The chains on their hands miraculously fell to the ground. Of course, the jailer runs in because if he loses these prisoners, he's a dead man. And he's ready to commit suicide. And Paul says, no, wait, we're all here. How? I don't know. But there's something powerful in the presence of a man of God. And the prisoners were paralyzed. And Paul saved the jailer's life. Out of gratitude, he brings Paul into his home that night. And Paul told him about Jesus. The jailer that night gets baptized into Christ with his whole family. Now, he wasn't the only one up in the middle of the night. The city rulers that had beaten Paul shoot straight up in bed when the earthquake hit. So you think of an earthquake as a natural disaster. They thought of an earthquake as the gods stomping their feet in anger. They thought, oh no, we made the gods angry. First light, they send a message, get Paul out of jail now. And the jailer, you should have seen his face. He's just like, Paul, guess what? I can let you go. Paul said, no, I'm not going anywhere. I am a Roman citizen, and they beat me without a trial. Did you know the penalty of beating a Roman citizen without a trial? You get beaten. Now, it's even worse in Philippi, because Philippi was a Roman colony. Many of its citizens were ex-military who moved there to retire. They have lots of Roman privileges, and they would lose every one of them if word got to Rome that they were beating a Roman citizen. Paul says, nope, I want those city leaders to come and escort me out. They apologize to my face. They walk me through the marketplace where they beat me unjustly, and then we'll have a conversation. The leaders, they have no choice. They don't want to do it, but Paul isn't just being snarky here, going, you know, you did me wrong, so I'm going to do you. No, here's his goal. Our church now is under the shadow of this illegal activity I'm accused of. Fact is, his opponents started the riot, not him. He was down by the river. And so Paul wants justice to be served so the church could be safe. And the leaders, they have to. They escort him out, and everyone sees they were wrong, Paul was right. And then they ask Paul, listen, you've caused a lot of trouble for us. We need you to leave Philippi. Now, what do you think Paul's going to say? We actually know what he did. And I don't know the conversation because it's not recorded in Acts 16, but I am 98% positive it went something like this. You want me to leave? You want me to just walk away from my church? All right, I'll do that. On one condition, you never touch or persecute my people. You so much as look cross-eyed at Christians, I swear to you, I'll be back. This explains why Paul was so devoted to the Philippians and why the Philippians were so devoted to him. See, when you live your life for position, you care about what people offer you. When you live your life for purpose, your joy comes from what you offer others. And when you show loyalty like Paul did to the Philippians, he took a beating so that they would never have to. They will show loyalty to him until the day he dies. So he says in verse 7, it is right for me to feel this way about all of you, since I have you in my heart. And whether I am in chains or defending and confirming the gospel, all of you share in God's grace with me. Your greatest happiness is in your greatest relationships, and chains will clarify your relationships. Chains will also, your impact is multiplied through chains. You realize that? That by suffering well, your position may lower, your impact of purpose will be multiplied. Listen to what Paul says in verse 12. And I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has actually served to advance the gospel. As a result, it's become clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I am in chains for Christ. Now, who was this palace guard that he talks about? They were none other than the security forces of Nero, the emperor. This is like the secret service of the Roman Empire. And they are coming to Paul every day, every 4 hours. Two new guards at the door, two new guards, one on Paul's right, one on Paul's left. Now who's in chains? It's like, they think Paul's in chains. No, they're the ones chained. Paul has a captive audience. And you know, when you meet a prisoner, what do you always ask? Or maybe you don't ask, or you want to ask, what'd you do? And Paul says, you really want to know? You're going to need about 4 hours. Oh, you got 4 hours, great. So it starts like this, and he goes, just preaches Jesus. And these guys are, they're converting to Christianity. And then the elite of the Roman military filter this Christian philosophy down to the troops on the ground. No one, no group of people was more mobile than Roman soldiers in the empire. And these guys went to the far-flung places of the Roman Empire preaching Christ. In Paul's wildest dreams, he never imagined a sit-down conversation with a group of Praetorian guards, let alone day after day and month after month and year after year. I don't know what name you gave to your chain, and I don't know how long you've been wearing your chain. Paul had it on for 4 years, and I know he had to have felt like, man, I'm stuck in prison. But you know the reality, don't you? When Paul was free, he planted over a dozen churches, and he converted thousands of people to Christ. But when Paul went to prison, he talked to the Praetorian Guard, and the thousands that Paul converted became millions that they converted. And in these 4 years, Paul wrote some letters, Philippians, Colossians, Ephesians. And because of what Paul wrote, not millions have come to Christ, but billions have to come to Christ. Your chain is yours. And you didn't choose it, it chose you. Somebody else put these chains on you. But what you do with these chains, if you can move from living for your position to living for your purpose, these chains can be force multipliers to magnify your influence beyond what you ever imagined. You want to be anti-fragile? Then wear these well. Because it's not just the Praetorian Guards preaching. Verse 14 says, this is always true. It's true of you. It's true of me. When you suffer well, here's what happens. Because of my chains, most of the brothers and sisters have become confident in the Lord and dare all the more to proclaim the gospel without fear. When you are bold in how you suffer, when your pain makes you better and not bitter, your children, your neighbors, your coworkers, your friends will be more willing to suffer for Jesus Christ so that his purpose can be fulfilled in you. Your relationships are clarified. your impact is multiplied and your purpose is prioritized. Paul describes something truly extraordinary next. Like, I wouldn't believe it if I didn't read it. It's true that some preach Christ out of envy and rivalry, but others out of goodwill. The latter do so out of love, knowing that I'm put here for the defense of the gospel. The former preach Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing that they can stir up trouble for me while I am in chains. So the situation is this. Paul's got these rivals. Okay, who doesn't? When Paul's in prison, they start preaching in the places he used to preach, taking advantage of the impact that he had. Now, how do you respond when your opponent advances beyond you? Like, for example, you're a starter on a team. Some new kid comes in and he's faster, he's better, he's stronger. How do you respond when he gets the starting point? How do you respond when you're in business and your rival next door wins the bid that you wanted? Or maybe you're divorced and your ex gets a promotion at work. Does that gall you? If you're living for your position, it will. That alone will impact your happiness like almost nothing else when opponents succeed. But when you change to live on purpose instead of for position, you care more about the team than you do about your starting position. Look, if you're on a team and you go, I want to wear a ring. I want to win the championship. If someone in your position has a better chance to make the team win the championship, can you not rejoice over that? Now, you still want to get better and exceed them and put them on the bench, no question. You still want to start, but your purpose is more important than your position. If your purpose in life is to raise your kids and give them every advantage that you never had, if your ex gets a promotion, can you not rejoice that your kids might get the privileges that you wanted them to have? See, this is a game changer. When we stop living for ourselves and start living for a higher purpose, our happiness is so much better. And that is what Paul is after for these people. Listen to how he responds in verse 18 about his opponents preaching. But what does it matter? The important thing is that in every way, whether from false motives or true, Christ is preached. And because of that, I rejoice. I would like to tell you that I have already mastered this message. I haven't. Probably like every one of us, I sometimes struggle with envy or rivalry. Somebody gets something I want and I pout about it. I want to be anti-fragile. And Paul is about to tell you how he got there. I don't know about you, but I'm all ears. Verse 20 says, I eagerly expect and hope that I will in no way be ashamed, but will have sufficient courage so that now, as always, Christ will be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. When you don't care whether you live or die, so long as your impact promotes your purpose. And I don't expect that everyone in the room is a Christian right now. Maybe your purpose is about business, or maybe your purpose is about sports, or maybe your purpose is about a political career. Whatever your purpose is, when your purpose is prioritized over your position, you have a far greater chance of happiness in life. For me, my purpose is found in Christ. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. We opened the service with a video of a number of people saying this verse. Would you join their chorus now and read this with me? For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. Again, for me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. Could you memorize that? For me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If we took a couple words out, and you got to fill in the blank, for to me, to live is, what would you put there? I know you want to say Christ, but is that the reality? See, I could look at your bank account and know what the reality is. I know what you put here. I can look at your calendar and I can know what you put there. I can look at your social media account and know what you put there. I know what you're living for because you tell everybody what you, like you have already filled in the blank. But once you fill in the first blank, you don't get to fill in the second blank. It automatically fills in depending on what you put here. Now, I suppose that some of you are thinking, wow, that's like, wow, I mean, that's pretty devoted to Christ. But what if the blanks were a box instead? And you had these symbols to choose from, or maybe you have your own symbol that you want to write in the box. If I were to say, if this box represents for me to live is, what do you put in the box? Maybe you live for love. That's nice. Or maybe you work out all the time and you're into health or music or money or food or Christ or family. What do you put in the box? The reality is, if the box says for me to live, we can put several things in the box. But once you move from to live to die, you're not going to put a lot of things in that box. You're going to have one item, maybe two. And when we survey people and ask them, what are you willing to die for? Not Christians, but just people. What are you willing to die for? Two things rise to the surface more than anything else. And every parent in here knows the first one. I'd die for my kids. That's not even a question. Not even a hesitation. I would die for my children. You're really saying, I would die for love. Then there's a group of brave men and women in the military who say, I would die for my country. They're not just dying for the country, they're dying for our freedom. Freedom and love are worth dying for. And if you ever ask me, why are you willing to die for Christ? Here's why. I have made a solemn oath, a pledge of loyalty to Jesus Christ. I would die for him in a heartbeat without a second thought. Why? Because he died, not for a family, not for children in his own home, but for the world, so that every man, every woman, and every child could experience freedom. Not political freedom in a country, but freedom from their past, freedom from their shame, freedom from their guilt. That is what is on offer through Jesus to you. You ask me why? For me to live as Christ and to die as gain? Because Jesus already lived for me and died for me. You want to be happy? I know you do. Then you have to realize that if what you're living for is not worth dying for, it's not worth living for. Holy Father, these are sobering thoughts. And this passage, for to me to live is Christ and to die is gain, it is so foundational to our happiness. I pray that every person in every seat on every campus would wrestle this to the ground. If they are not happy, to train for happiness, to be anti-fragile so that they could live for purpose and not position, and not just to make Jesus famous, but to gain ground in their own happiness and health. We pray this in the powerful name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Hey, thank you all for being here. And I just want to say this. There is a happiness pandemic across America. And I think we should be a people that celebrate so wildly that we attract others to us. And I just want to say to you seriously, I know it's June, I know people are getting out of town and you got a lot of things going on, but for this series in particular, if you have a friend, a family member who needs to gain in happiness, I want to invite you to invite them over the next few weeks. It will be helpful to make their lives better. Have a great week. God bless you guys.